Let's get to the land use meeting started. Okay, we have a signing sheet. Is it gone around?
Yeah, I got it.
Just keep signing. Okay, call the roll. I'm just going to go off the sheet here. I got Councilman Bell, Council President Bullock is absent. Councilman Cartier, Councilwoman Diller, Councilman Hollins, Councilwoman Kilpatrick, Councilman Powers, myself, Joe Retta, Councilman Sheldon, Councilman Smiley, Councilman Street, Councilman Taggart, and Councilman Weiner. What's the pleasure on the minutes?
Both approve.
Second. All favor?
Aye.
Okay, the first on the agenda, we have a resolution. It's a plan of Lighthouse Farm in St. George's 100, north side of Port Penn Road, directly across from Jeffrey's Pine Drive, major subdivision. It's in Councilman Bell's.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As per title, and I guess what I would do at this time is that we do have representation from the applicant, and you know, I think as far as presenting the plan or the history of the plan, if we could, would be actually to call on the applicant at this point.
Okay. It's your pleasure.
Thank you, Councilman Bell. Members of County Council, my name is Richard Beck. I'm with the Morris James Law Firm. I'm here on behalf of the applicants, Helen Elkins, and now the estate of Maris Van Allen through her heirs. This project involves one of two parcels of land that these ladies inherited from their parents, the other being on the far side of Route 1 and being condemned by DelDOT for Route 301. This property was the subject of an application filed in 2005, and we are here 2014 seeking approval for what is in most parlance a gentle development of 54 homes on 109 acres of land. That's approximately one home per 2 acres. And the property has been through quite a lot of history in terms of first working through a phasing issue so that 41 lots will be developable in phase one, but no more than that until highway improvements are completed to an intersection. Then the remaining lots could go forward, and most recently working through a drainage issue concern where the applicants were being asked to install drainage on the southern property, the downstream property, Pine Hill Farms, and actually went through quite a process to have drainage on the downstream property declared a Century 21st project and putting up funds to accomplish installation of drainage on that property, although we felt and continue to feel that constitutionally they couldn't be really required to do that because the drainage that they're going to be putting downstream is actually less after improvement than it is in its present state. Those issues were all worked through because the Soil Conservation District, in meeting with the residents, discovered that the residents would prefer not to have further drainage work being installed on their property. The plans were then re-engineered so that the drainage would continue to flow through the same drainage pipe as it currently does, and as I say, will not increase over its present state. So it's a fairly simple plan, less than or about 1 acre, one home per 2 acres, that's gentle, and a responsible effort to contain the drainage and otherwise in compliance, as far as we can tell, with all requirements that the county imposes. I know your time is valuable, so rather than attempt to go into any more detail, if I may respond to your questions, I'd be grateful to have them.
Councilman Smiley.
Yeah, it just may be a matter of semantics, but I just want to clear up. You said that it's one home per 2 acres. Does that mean there are 2-acre lots?
No.
Thank you.
Because there's water resource protection area, and a fair amount of the property is just not being developed.
That's what I anticipate. I just wanted to clarify because of the terminology used. Thank you.
Councilman Bell?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As was stated by Mr. Beck, this plan has been around for quite a long time now. Traffic impact study done back in October 24th, 2006. And so it has been quite a long time. When we talk about water protection areas and the size of lots and septic, in what I still consider a very environmentally sensitive area, I have to raise concerns over the fact of the area itself. I guess one of my concerns is the fact that we have worked for several years now, and I think that it's become a little bit more apparent. And I think that the county has an opportunity to acquire some federal funding and some assistance from the state in what we're hoping to be a farmland preservation area, region. If you look at the whole Fort Penn corridor, this new project with septic systems is in that area. And I know we can't turn back the clock and say, well, when the plan was introduced, that wasn't being discussed, but it's being discussed now. And I think that I have a serious concern over that from the standpoint that 54 homes, 2-acre lots, and when you look at a water protection type area, you look at the environment and our initiatives to try to preserve the farms in that area, and then, like I say, to put 54 more homes on septic in that very area, I have concerns over it. I guess the interconnectivity between Dutch Neck Farms and this particular development, we just spoke briefly right before the meeting, but will there be interconnectivity of any of the roadways between Dutch Neck Farms and the new Lighthouse Farms, proposed Lighthouse Farms development?
I'm looking at the first page of the plan, Councilman, and I'm seeing something that my eyes won't work. Wooden Shoe Court. And I believe that, as required by the Land Use Department, does create interconnectivity with Dutch Neck Farms.
Okay. And my question, once again, would be, I have throughout several years now, when this plan was being discussed earlier, concerns raised to me by residents within Dutch Neck Farms off Dutch Neck Road, which are homes that have swales, drainage swales in the front, no sidewalks, no lighting, children play in the street areas, and to take from a public safety perspective and require to have interconnectivity with those type of roadways into a development that which will be paved, have sidewalks, street lights. I find it hard to believe, knowing some of the history south of the canal with Asbury Chase and Grandview Farms, that folks will not take advantage of cutting through an older development, like I say, with no sidewalks, no lights, drainage swales, kids in the street, to take a shortcut out to Route 13 and Boyd's Corner Road light through that new development. So I question public safety from the standpoint of the residents that currently live within Dutch Neck Farms with this new development and the requirement of interconnectivity.
I'm not quite sure how to respond because I think it was a requirement that was imposed as opposed to an interconnection that was affirmatively sought. Mm-hmm. I have a recollection, which may be a bit vague at this point in time, but of some years ago there being a discussion, a proposal, as to whether this interconnection could somehow be like for emergency vehicles as opposed to something that would be a full throughway, because as you I'm sure can imagine, Councilman, the neighbors, the future neighbors, your future constituents, would probably prefer not to have, you know, the shortcut going through Lighthouse Farm up into a neighboring community. So my only way to respond to it is that if we were invited to make that just some type of an emergency situation, however that might work, I'm sure there would not be resistance to that on the part of my clients. But I think ultimately what we're attempting to do is simply comply with the requirements of the code in order to achieve plan approval. And I don't know how further to respond, really, with that. And I'm not rebutting your concerns in any way. It's just that's the situation in which we are.
Would someone from land use be able to respond to if this is, in fact, a requirement? Who is it a requirement by? Is it DelDOT? Is it land use? And, you know, I can't speak for the future residents of Lighthouse Farm, but I can speak for the residents that currently live in Dutch Neck Farms, and, you know, they're opposed to interconnectivity through that development.
Okay. I believe George Haggerty is standing up.
Councilman Bell, members of County Council, George Haggerty, Assistant General Manager, Land Use Department. I'm here because I'm one of the few people that's that old. This plan has been around for that long a period of time. There were some initial questions that were raised when this plan came about that resulted in a planning board decision, an appeal of the department's decision, and a planning board decision. But I'll just read you on the question that you asked about the connection and to the property. The third question on appeal answers whether the applicant should be required to pave a stub street to an adjacent undeveloped property. Section 4020-230F of the UDC requires that the subdivision shall be connected to each other to provide reasonable access within a superblock. The street connections shall follow the local circulation pattern. The section 4021-111 states to minimize vehicular access points on arterial and collector roads, the department and DelDOT may, when the first development occurs in the area, develop a local circulation plan. The circulation plan shall identify desired collector and residential collectors within a superblock area, areas in the frontage type roads for reverse frontage and preferred intersection locations. The local circulation plan shall be based on the property maps, zoning, and topography and alignment information. No such circulation plan has been offered as to the evidence of the record in this instance appeal, nor has the existence of such plan been cited either verbally or written to the board. Without acknowledgement that compliance with local circulation plans required, the applicants have volunteered to dedicate the right-of-way to the intersection to an adjacent parcel, which future development and beyond the horizon, but object to the department's requirement of interconnection all the way to the property line of the adjacent parcel. So the code states that the department may develop a circulation plan, and therefore, even if the circulation plan does not yet exist, it makes sense for the developer to finish and show the plan. So essentially what we've got is we were in argument about whether or not they showed the connection, whether or not you had to pave up to the connection, and we won that point. We lost the other 2 points, incidentally, in the plan, because we had argued that they shouldn't do anything because they had a level of service issue, and the planning board said you can do 41 units and then get the roads fixed. So all of that diatribe that I just read you was really about what our codes kind of look to in terms of trying to provide interconnection. I've listened to you, I've stood before you all and had conversations on a regular basis about interconnection. It's certainly a good thing to do, and it's certainly a bad thing to do, depending on whether you're trying to isolate yourself or whether you're trying to make it better. I think your specific question was, would we go back and take a look at it and try to evaluate it to see if there was some more clarity we can add to it? I think that that would be appropriate for us to at least take a look at. I'm not confident I can give you that the answer won't be the code obligates us to do this, the code that you all have passed on to us, but it's certainly a question that you've asked, and I think that we're certainly willing to do it. And I heard the applicant's offer as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Councilwoman?
Thank you. While you're going back and looking at this, is it feasible to build in traffic calming if it's not something that can be closed, so that it's not just a free-flowing road, but that somebody has some hindrance in going over, which doesn't make it exactly appealing to use as cut-through? It's a lot easier to do traffic calming in the beginning than it is to have somebody try to retrofit it after the fact.
Okay, we can certainly take a look at that.
Hold on a minute, George. Okay, go ahead, Councilman.
I think the phasing is a numerical phasing. No more than 41 units can be constructed and occupied until the intersection improvements at Route 13 have been completed. I'm not suggesting that there is a line.
You've got a cul-de-sac on wherever these names are, Southern Pocono Court. Really, four.
I confess I'm not seeing a phase line.
Not a phase line, but I would like to pull it where you're not at the end of the subdivision.
Well, there are three lots there beyond that, and it's possibly the cul-de-sac is to make it easy to turn around at that point without going all the way down to the last lots. I see those lots 45 through 40, 45, 4, 3, and 2, and I certainly do not purport to be the engineer and to understand the design constraints, but it's looking to me as though the cul-de-sac, rather than put way down at the end, has been put here as a matter of convenience. In case someone is going down and wants to turn around, they don't have to go all the way down and do that back, that L-shaped backing movement there. I see there's another cul-de-sac there's another one of a similar nature. It looks as though in the northeast, up at the northeast end, close to Dutch Neck Farms.
Yeah, one of the west. The one That would be north of that one. I'm just questioning now, why is the cul-de-sac at the end of the road?
Well, I will simply say that I don't have the engineering background to answer beyond what is a common sense response, and I think that's the common sense response. Well, Councilman, but I understand your puzzlement.
The common sense would be, especially if you got to get a truck down there and turn around. That's going to be awful hard. Snow plowing and everything. The fire truck up into that. I haven't found any engineer that has common sense. There's a couple of them.
Well, I suppose that could be said of.
And we can debate that all day, but I've seen too much stuff that's. I didn't know if that's where you're ending with your lots, and then you're going to go further from it, but you got an LOD line going across there, leaving about 10 or 12 lots out.
I count 7 lots that would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 that are beyond
11, 12, 13.
All right, you're coming up with a count maybe where I'm not seeing a further count.
What's the LOD stand for?
LOD?
Yeah.
Just the first time you've seen the plan.
It's on the front page of the plan.
Yeah, I'm just not even seeing where the LOD is.
It's right above where your it starts, goes across that hole.
Oh. I think that's a line of demarcation to private open space. Is that where you're looking at private open space?
It's right in the middle of lots.
I'm sorry.
I'm just trying to figure out where your 40-something lots are. And then we kind of questioned after your cul-de-sac's halfway down. I think somebody ought to look into that.
Limit of disturbance, thanks very much, for land use assistance. It's a limit of disturbance then.
I know it's not the contour of the problem. Well, yeah, there's your WRP. That's what the line is. One of them. All right.
Councilman Weiner.
Thank you. I know the answer to the first question I'm going to ask, but I just want to put it on the record. Would you address the transit orientation and bike ped friendliness of this development?
Well, I know that it was put together years ago. I doubt it had the same attention to bike friendliness and transit orientation as we have today. There's certainly, it is not designed, for example, for public transportation to go in and out. I don't think there's anything about the design that is particularly unbike friendly, but if you're asking me whether it was designed with bike internal bike lanes or, you know, that sort of thing, I would have to say no.
As members of council know, that's just a standard question that I ask all the time.
Okay.
Just drilling down, you noted for the record, and the plan indicates that there's a failing level of service at Boyd's Corner. Do you recall which turning vectors or through movements are in failure, and if so, what is the required level of service south of the canal at this location?
I will say I really do not recall the details of the study. I know that at 41 lots, even at this point in time, when we had, I guess, what might be considered a vigorous development and traffic projection climate, that 41 lots was deemed really de minimis. And the offer had been either to permanently reduce to 41 lots and go forward, or plan for 54 but have nothing until the improvements were installed. And what we sought and obtained was a phasing that allowed the 41 de minimis to go forward, the 54, the balance to be put aside in accordance with, you know, with the code at the time. And I think it's fair to say that it's it will be probably quite a while before anyone sees even 41 lots there because of the current market conditions.
Mm-hmm.
These my clients are elderly, as I say. The older sister a few months ago passed from pancreatic cancer, and so now it's just her younger sister and her two children who have a considerable investment in this and are attempting to see it through rather than lose it. So that's where we are today. It's not as though we have a builder developers who are knocking down the doors, you know, to construct this.
Mm-hmm. So and my final comment is the observation I make from a legal perspective, I understand that this is by right, but from an emotional point of view, along this Port Penn Road, Boyd's Corner, it's just beautiful, and I wish that Newcastle County, in hindsight, it had had the wisdom to have preserved this land from development. And that's all I can say.
And I, for not that it will make any kind of real difference, but emotionally, the decision was made to try to preserve the farm, which, you know, so that is what is seen here as you initially come in. That's been preserved. There's a significant amount of private open space further up. And I think that there will be a genuine desire on the part of the people who currently own this property to see that whoever is going to take it over will agree to deal with it in a very sensitive manner, because they still have a feeling toward the land. Now, as far as putting in, my suggestion would be the kind of speed, not bumps, they're kind of called speed
humps.
Tables. They're almost like a table.
Yeah.
Going into Kennett Square,
mm-hmm.
they don't jar the car, but they really do work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if there was a sense that it would be great to put those in at the time when this wooden shoe court is paved, and the appeal was taken not to have that connectivity, but to put them in at that point, that would work well for both communities, because it would certainly discourage race through activity. And we had been told that there were people on Wooden Shoe Court in Dutch Neck Farms where, for example, kids played basketball and that sort of thing. So it was a concern for them as well as for us not to have this be some sort of
speed through.
Speed, yeah, something that people would just want to rush through. So that we'd welcome that idea as long as the county and DelDOT would.
Well, I speaking for myself, I would encourage interconnectivity, although I well know that our fondness, as George Haggerty said, for interconnectivity faces the reality of constituents. But certainly for bike ped interconnectivity and for pedestrian automobile interconnectivity, a table would be a wonderful addition and a good compromise. And I guess the last thing I'd like to say is that if we can protect the viewshed along the major roads through clustering, I think we'll be doing the right thing for future generations. And certainly it's more conducive to build in a cluster than it is to build cookie-cutter infrastructure. Although this is going to be on septic, which makes that point irrelevant.
Councilman Bell.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the question would be, this particular plan, it dates back to 2006. Have there been any significant revisions to this plan since then?
Yes.
Okay. And I guess the point that I'm about to make here is that in most cases where proposed development is being presented before council in a land use committee meeting, normally folks have engineering design folks at the meeting so they can address the design, any concerns, look into things, and you know, get those things answered. And I don't get that kind of sense in this presentation. It's not the normal type of presentation I think as council has grown accustomed to. We typically have the engineering firm there that can present and answer the questions as far as not only interconnectivity, but the turnarounds, cul-de-sacs, things of that nature. So kind of find it a little different than what we've done in the past. And so I don't know whether, with some of the questions that have been generated or asked, whether the applicant would consider coming back to a future land use committee meeting with the engineering so that the questions could be answered. I'm not sure it's a requirement, but it would seem to me that I'm not particularly pleased with the way this is being presented today.
I agree. Some of the technical questions.
Well, I hope I've done a good job with the, with at least the interconnectivity.
Yeah.
I know Mr. Haggerty has responded. We have certainly done what we could to go. This has gone through a lot to try and get here today. I'm certain my clients are not interested in creating an impression with council that is unfavorable. I know that council can appreciate the fact that there has been already a tremendous expense entailed, especially trying to work through the drainage issues where they put up a considerable amount of money to help solve a drainage problem on an adjoining land. So their heart is certainly in the right place. I'm reminded of the saying, and so I'll probably regret saying sure. Let's resume this, what is it, in 2 weeks? Is it 2 weeks that we would come back? I'm reminded of the saying, no good deed goes unpunished. But I'm sure that if there is a connection, a concern here that we can address that doesn't throw this whole thing into a problem, there would be a desire to do that. So if that is helpful, and it doesn't create too much of a delay, I will point out, since I don't know the council's aware of this, that we are under an extension deadline with the Court of Chancery, because it was put into Court of Chancery because of certain deadlines that were pending, and an effort was made then to work this out amicably rather than through litigation. It actually went to the board for appeal. So I'd like to take a moment, if I can, just let me look at the extension order we have to make sure I'm not doing something that is suddenly going to put us in violation of our court order. I know Vice Chancellor.
Yeah, a point of information, the next Land Use Committee meeting is Monday, November 10th.
This. All right, I think the court will allow us, and it would be understood that we would extend further in order to respond to any questions, and I will ask Mr. Williams if he'll be here in an effort to respond to your questions about the cul-de-sac. If there are other questions that you would like the engineers to be prepared to address, would you mind sharing them so at least we can be as efficient as possible?
Traffic study.
Okay. You just want to know what the old traffic study had provided, so you can respond to that. Yes.
Before we get too far, we have another councilman who had his hand up. Okay, one big question.
I've got a question. There's going to be a maintenance agreement, and you've got an escrow amount. What is projected that it's going to cost for this maintenance? Because 57.06 acres is open space, and the maintenance, and it's not thrown where you could farm it, as I think Councilman Weiner would rather see as a view shed, but it's thrown throughout your whole subdivision, which is leaving 49 acres is what you're building 54 homes on. But what I've asked this on other...
Yes, I...
Because, I mean, I have... When you start getting 50%, it ends up costing almost another mortgage payment to maintain that property.
And
It's doing it in Bayberry. Bayberry's going to have a 13-month mortgage payment once the maintenance comes in.
And Councilman, you have made this point over and over. And I appreciate the wisdom behind it. I wish it sounds like one of the interconnectivity balance questions too, pluses and minuses. Everyone wants the open space, then how is it paid for? Again, I will ask the engineer to be able to respond to that. Personally, I was not involved in the calculations to set up the open space escrow and what the maintenance would be.
One thing that I think with the general manager and I, that hasn't been put into it because I have so many maintenance quotes. I mean, I have maintenance quotes that cost them $25,000 a year just for their insurance, liability insurance. And we haven't been projecting that into this. So when you have this much space, we're going to have liabilities. They're going to have, not the county, but
yes,
they're going to have liabilities for that property.
Councilman?
Mr. Chairman, would it be in order to table this particular plan until the next Land Use Committee meeting?
For technical purposes?
Second.
Yeah, I can, yes.
I so move.
Second.
All in favor?
Discussion.
Okay, point of order. Three questions. Okay, Councilman Weiner first.
Thank you. I heard first an offer to just come back rather than use one of the two statutory permissions to refer it back. I would suggest respectfully that we take advantage of that. Secondly, if we're going to proceed by way of one of the two statutory tablings, then we would need to have more on the record as to the reasons. So rather than to get into that, I would suggest that we simply take advantage of the good graces of the attorney for the applicant and allow it to be continued to November 10th.
I would agree with that.
And then I wanted to before we table this, give the applicant's attorney an understanding of some of the questions that I'm going to want answered.
Okay, we have a couple more questions. Councilor Smiley.
Sure, I'd ask council to clarify.
Exactly.
I mean, we're in a land use committee meeting, and the most I've ever heard, and I've done it myself, was to inform council that at the council meeting, when it was brought forward, it would be tabled at that time. I've never tabled in an actual committee meeting before. So I'd like to make sure we're following the correct procedure, if I may.
Yeah.
Councilman Carrier?
I echo Councilman Smiley's sentiments, and I mean, if the applicant and the sponsoring councilman agreed to a delay in the course of this meeting, that's one thing. The tablings occur in a council session.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would graciously accept the offer of the legal counsel for the applicant to come back to a future land use committee meeting and present a more detailed presentation of it without this being actually a motion to table or sending it back to land use at this time.
Yeah. All right. Councilor Weiner.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the initiative on the part of a sponsoring council person. I did want to state for the record that were we to go to one of the two statutory tabling that council has made a matter of record of in previous projects such as the pilot school, that and the legal counsel for the county has so opined that the reasons for the tabling have to be stated on the record. Now the point of my discussion is to enumerate for the benefit of counsel for the applicant some of the questions that I'm going to want to explore on November 10th. May I proceed?
Okay, well, try and condense it. We got one more council person.
Yeah.
Because they have
another meeting. I understand, meeting. But brevity is
good. I know, but they have another meeting, so they want to answer the question, and then we have a presentation.
I understand.
Which is only lengthy.
And I want the applicant and their engineer to be prepared to answer the question. The plan data notes that there's going to be a phase two construction when Port Penn Road is widened to DLDOT standards from the eastern edge of the property to U.S. Route 13. That's note 44 sub small d. And then 44 small e says, prior to the issuance of the 20th building permit in phase one, the developer should enter into an agreement with DLDOT to fund an equitable share of any signal improvement of Port Penn U.S. Route 13 intersection. I'd just like to understand what the applicable level of service is, what constitutes an equitable share, if DLDOT's made that determination, and what would the widening consist of? Because this is a beautiful country road. We're putting more traffic on there than there ought to be from a layman's point of view, and I just want to understand how that's going to affect it. And then lastly, I'd like to understand what sort of viewshed protection we can give, if not 100%, what sort of opacity protection can we give to those that want to enjoy the beauty of the country roads from the houses that will be built there. Thank you.
May I conclude just by saying that the effort here should not be understood as somehow an admission or suggestion that the plan is not in conformity with law. The effort is to try to maintain a relationship with the county and the government that, while it's gone through some strains in the past 9 years, nevertheless, I think my clients would wish to have a sense that they were responsible people and attempting to act in a responsible manner. So with that, is it possible to be assured that it will come up at the next meeting, because the time is a factor? Would there be a reason why it couldn't come up at the next one?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that, I think that has to conform with anything else that's going to be scheduled. As far as the next meeting, I would think that if it's open, that it could certainly be on the next meeting. The one thing that I want to make clear is that based upon the engineer's presentation, that we still reserve the right as council if we feel that there's any technical questions, specific questions concerning compliance with the law that we may feel haven't been complied with. We still reserve the right at the council meeting to move to send that back to land use to answer a specific question.
I think that's been clear, and I hope I have, in an appropriate manner, expressed my hope that this effort to be accommodating and to work interactively is not going to just be turned around into a how many things can we find as a basis for sending it back. I'm hopeful that there is good faith on both sides of the equation here, and that's the basis upon which I would certainly proceed and understand your reservation.
Right. Councilman, we've got our counselor here. She's going to make a statement.
I'm Carol Dolan, counsel to council. I just wanted to advise both the applicant and council to remind you that the standard in the code is that county council may move to table a plan up to two times and to send it back to the Department of Land Use to answer questions about technical compliance with the law And certainly they could do that in conjunction with the applicant, but I don't believe that county council would want to waive their legal right under the code. Certainly that would be within the discretion of council.
Quite understood. No waiver.
Question for clarification. Councilman Smiley?
Just so we're sure of the applicant and everyone's aware of procedure forward, if the applicant submits a letter to council requesting a tabling at the next council meeting, and that would suffice to table it and preserve the council member's right to return to land use two times, correct? Or no?
Carol Dolan, Council of the Council. That is not addressed in the code, Council Member Smiley, but it has been done in the past because the applicant's due process rights would not be abrogated if, in fact, the applicant, him or herself, determines that they wish for a tabling.
That was my understanding. Since the applicant was in agreement, I just thought that would be the cleanest way to do it.
Councilman Tag?
No, I was just hoping we could get the council to council up there because we had a lot of conversation, a lot of questions were asked and answered by seeing the same person, and legal advice somehow mingled in that too, so I wanted to hear from council to council just to be sure where the footing was we are with this applicant, because at one time a volunteer, there could possibly be two more defers, you know, I mean, we wanted to be clear where we were at here.
Okay. Any other questions? Anything from the public? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Beck.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have a presentation, analysis of workforce housing and housing needs for Newcastle County. At this time, we'll turn it over to Councilman Hollins to do the intro on this, but also we're going to hold the questions till the end of the presentation from the council. Councilman Hollins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will discuss the presentation of the analysis of workforce housing and the housing needs of Newcastle County. I would like to give council members and the public just a little update on where we've been so far. We have had several meetings with the housing task force that consists of a lot of stakeholders and interested parties from Newcastle County public. I have worked diligently along with the general manager of land use, along with the consultants that we have that you will hear from in just a couple of minutes, in order to prepare the legislation that has been introduced by County Council and will be heard tomorrow by the PLUS Committee, the Planning Committee down at the State of Delaware in Dover tomorrow morning. We have received a number of offers to help us craft the legislation from a number of different groups, some that are within the task force and some that are not. I thought it was the best path going forward that we would consult with those folk in the country who have had experience to help us to understand better the failures of the workforce housing legislation, as well as having had experience across the country and are recognized as experts in the area of inclusionary zoning, people that have the capacity to understand all of the HUD regulations, which we are, in fact, a HUD agency here in Newcastle County. With that, if we were to have gone to any of the agencies that had offered us the help, then the question would be, which agency would we go to? So I thought it would be better as a path forward to engage people who have no skin in the game, as you would say here locally, but folk who would give us an independent analysis of the conditions here in Newcastle County with the housing needs of Newcastle County and the economics that are specific to Newcastle County, even though we are in the HUD market area. My aide, Nakai Triller, is handing out two or three pieces that I thought would be helpful. I want the public to know that County Council itself, we've just received the plan. As a matter of fact, it was emailed to County Council members on Friday, so we will avoid any notion that somehow we were working in darkness and that the public was not aware. We were finally able to have the consultants present here today, and we did an emergency to make certain that we could get this presentation on today's agenda for Land Use Committee. And I apologize for the delay. We could not get right into it because we were the last people to get onto this agenda. However, having gotten the report sent to County Council members electronically on Friday, over the weekend, I did read the report. I think it's very well done. I would encourage anyone to read the report before passing judgment on the legislation, simply because the legislation is a derivative of the report. So if you read the legislation without having read the report, I don't think you're going to do yourself any real good by trying to digest the legislation without reading the report. To that end, I read the report and sent to County Council members yesterday, along with the members of the task force, some critical points that I believe that are contained within the report to save time of County Council members as well as the task force members for not having to read the entire report. That was sent on yesterday. My aide is handing that particular email out, as well as the executive summary of the report, which is an easy read. It's a two-page document contained within the report. My aide is also handing that out. Finally, before I yield to the General Manager of Land Use to introduce our consultants, I just want to read from the Comprehensive Plan 2012 Newcastle County. The County Council, as everyone knows, is the recipient of federal dollars, HUD dollars. In the year 2010-2011, County Council received in excess of $6 million in federal funds for housing programs here in Newcastle County. And that does not include NSP funds, which we received several million dollars of NSP funds to help stabilize communities right here in Newcastle County. They were all federal dollars. And as Newcastle County is the recipient of federal housing funds, the county is obligated to affirmatively further fair housing. The county's obligation to refrain from discrimination is no longer acceptable. The county must now certify to the federal government that county's federal funded housing programs assist in ending discrimination and segregation to the point where the supply of genuinely open housing increases. These new requirements are enforced by HUD, and noncompliance can result in the forfeiture of federal funds for community development and housing programs within Newcastle County. In other words, we are mandated to have laws that affirmatively address to further fair housing. I would just like to add that there is a concurrent ordinance that will repeal the workforce housing legislation if we are in fact successful in passing the new legislation that is being recommended to County Council. That legislation, if passed, I will move forward to repeal the workforce housing legislation. I also want to make it very clear that even though I believe it is perhaps necessary to repeal the workforce housing, that is not the end. I cannot repeal workforce housing and see that as the benefit to Newcastle County government. If we pass legislation as a better product, it's one thing. But to repeal the legislation without another product is not an option. I cannot support not having a fair housing component to our comprehensive plan here in Newcastle County, as we are a recipient of millions of dollars of HUD dollars. With that, I will yield to the General Manager of Land Use to go from here, and she will introduce our guests. And as Councilman Redder has stated, we would hope that council members will hold their questions and their comments until the presentations are complete.
Just come up to this.
Thank you very much. As Councilman Hollins has expressed, the goal here was to look at a pragmatic approach to what moved from workforce housing to moderately priced dwelling units, address the longstanding issues, and to bring in a team that had both experience in building affordable and moderately priced housing and national experts who have done this all around the country. With that said, I'd like to introduce Kathleen Koch, who's the director of Arundel Community Development Services in Anne Arundel County, and Patrick Mayer, who is the head of Innovative Housing Institutes, who's operated in putting together programs in many major cities and all across the country. We also have available to answer questions Department of Land Use, the Office of Law, Carrie Casey, Stephanie Rizzo, Community Services, and we'll be available. Thank you.
Excuse me, Kathleen. Some of the public members cannot hear well enough, so we may want to alter just a little bit to use the lectern where there's a microphone.
There's one here and there's another one over there. If you want to do a tag team,
okay.
You can stay. You can sit down here.
Okay. Good afternoon. Is that better? Okay, so the Land Use Department asked us to assess the county's current market conditions and its approach to providing moderately priced housing through the county's existing workforce housing ordinance. We were asked to look at the current housing market and the need for moderately priced housing in the county and how that need might be met in the current conditions. We began our process with a review of the existing ordinance, which was originally adopted by the county in February 2008. We studied the housing market data and the income statistics for the county, as well as we did a thorough review of all the documents used by the county to implement the workforce housing ordinance. Interviews were held with county staff, elected officials, and the developers who are currently developing subdivisions approved through the workforce housing ordinance. In addition, an economist was asked to review the various economic assumptions in the report to ensure that there was economic viability in our recommendations. And finally, focus groups meetings were held with key housing stakeholders, including the Home Builders Association of Delaware, the Board of Realtors, the Delaware Housing Coalition, and the Delaware AARP chapter. One of the big issues the consulting team found with the existing ordinance was the fact that the downturn in the housing market has had on the developer's ability to market the workforce housing units. When the original ordinance was approved in 2008, the existing median house price was $400,000. In 2013, the median sales price for new construction was just a little over $326,000, a drop of about 18%. An issue is definitely created when the median sales price is lower than the maximum house price for the workforce housing units. When the workforce housing unit is at a price that is equal to or higher than the median house on the market, the developer has a very difficult time selling the units. Moderately priced housing ordinances across the country work best when there's a difference between the market and the moderately priced maximum house price required by the program. A need for affordable housing in the county continues to exist, including housing for your teachers, policemen, firemen, and your healthcare practitioners. And they all have a difficult time in finding housing that they can afford close to where they work. The current housing workforce housing ordinance serves households with incomes up to 120% of median income. For a newly constructed house, the current legislation allows that houses can be priced up to just a little over $346,000 above That is above the medium sales price, which is currently at $326,000. The new ordinance that the consulting team is proposing recommends the new program serve up to 90% of the area median income. And that's for the Philadelphia metropolitan statistical area, 90% of that, the area-wide median income. By serving this income bracket, you are serving an income that is just below what your market is currently serving. Currently, a family of four at 90% has an income of just a little over $70,000. The developers interviewed for this study said that they were having a very difficult time selling the workforce housing units because of the 15-year affordability requirement. However, we have found, as many jurisdictions across the country have found, that this compliance period requirement is not an issue when there is a difference between the market and the price of the housing units being produced through the moderately priced housing program. The final issue the consulting team found was that the community residents viewed the density bonus with a voluntary program as excessive. Based on our analysis and the consulting team's experience and knowledge of successful moderately priced housing programs and policies across the country, we are recommending that the county consider a new ordinance that requires moderately priced dwelling units to be provided as part of all residential rezoning applications. Under this process, density would be lessened and the development standards would not have to be reduced. Quality design could be encouraged and achieved with full public participation and review through the established rezoning process. The requirement would only apply if a developer chose to go through the rezoning process. Under the recommended approval, all residentially zoned developments would be required to make 15% to 20% of the units moderately priced. And again, the moderately priced for a family of four at 90%, the price of the house would be approximately $240,000. I'm now going to turn it over to Patrick, who's going to go through some of the economic data and some of the economic statistics that we use to base our recommendations on.
Thank you, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be here. My name again is Patrick Mayer. I'm the Executive Director of the Innovative Housing Institute. As Kathy mentioned, we're an organization that actually grew out of the Montgomery County, Maryland experience. Many of you know that Montgomery County, Maryland was really the pioneer in inclusionary housing nationally. I had the pleasure of serving Montgomery County for 27 years in a variety of positions and learned a great deal about how inclusionary housing can work and how it really needs to respond to the circumstances of a given market. Since 2003, I've been the Executive Director of the Innovative Housing Institute. We have offices both in Baltimore and in Washington, D.C. We do consulting around the country. As Kathy mentioned, we're also a 501c3 nonprofit organization. One of our activities is that we have a group that's called the National Inclusionary Housing Conference, which convenes practitioners from all around the country to really talk about the challenges of implementing a program like this and really to spread best practices and to gain the knowledge necessary to implement a program of this sort. I wanted to talk just a little bit just about the circumstance in Newcastle County, and one of the things that we've learned in terms of our approach is that the best inclusionary housing programs are those that are tailored carefully to the local economy, to the local needs of the community, and really to the type of housing that's being developed within the market and the price levels of that market. So the best programs are those that are not, I'll say, a transfer of knowledge from somewhere else, but one that is really brought about through a careful study of the local conditions and what housing is being sold for and what, and in particular, who needs housing and how they are able to be served. We carried out a particularly, a fairly detailed analysis in terms of the price levels and rent levels and income levels of households within Newcastle County and what they need in terms of affordable housing. And I think, as Kathy mentioned, the metropolitan statistical area that Newcastle County is part of is the Philadelphia region, We use the income levels for the Philadelphia MSA to guide the levels that would be affordable. And for those of you, and I'm going to say I'm hoping that you have our report. I'm looking at page 24 of it, which is the beginning of the economic analysis. And I'd like to kind of walk you through what our suppositions were in going through that analysis. Okay, so the first part of that is that we're suggesting that various income levels be served. And initially, the income level that we're recommending for the rental program was 60% of median. I understand that's been increased to 75% in the draft legislation. For the home ownership program, we're recommending that the units that are produced be divided between two income levels, 75% of area median income and 90% of area median income. And the table, the first table on that page, describes the actual incomes adjusted by household size, again, based on this Metropolitan Statistical Area publication. These are the various tiers that this program is aimed at. In terms of the rental qualifying incomes, the table that's at the bottom of that page needs to be adjusted now to the 75% of AMI, but you can see what that is by looking at the table above. That would be the qualifying level for rental income households. Turning to the next page, this is how what people can afford is calculated. And it starts with a qualifying income level of 65 and 80% of area median income. What we've learned as we develop programs around the country is that it's important to have a window of eligibility between the maximum level that a family can qualify to be part of the program, 90% in the case of our recommendation, 75% in terms of the lower priced units, and then have a tier of income below that so that a group of people under that qualifying income level can in fact qualify and afford these homes. This maximum sales price calculation table describes how you calculate what people can afford to pay for a mortgage payment and to have the other things that they'll need to have to afford to purchase a home. At the bottom of that table, you'll see the actual maximum sales price that we say is affordable to families at those two levels, 75% of area median income and 90% of area median income. And again, as you go across that table, it's adjusted by household size, which you see at the top of the table. Now, I'll say that we made a couple of suppositions in trying to decide how this works best for the development community, for home builders and people that we're actually looking to help contribute to this important community need. And part of what we believe is it really has to be something that is a positive, a net positive for the development community to want to participate and not choose to develop in some other marketplace or not develop at all, which is a concern I'm sure you'll hear from the development community. So part of the way we believe programs should be structured is with public incentives that offer offsetting values to the development community. And I'll say in this analysis, there's really two types of offsets. One is simply in the case of developers that are developing without seeking a rezoning, we're suggesting that they be able to receive a 20% density bonus above the base density that otherwise would be entitled to by right. That additional density bonus, that 20% would come with a requirement that 10% of the total number of units would be affordable. And again, as we're suggesting here, that 10%, and I'll do a simple math exercise, and we actually see it at the bottom of that next page. Table 9 essentially says that if a developer was building or had the development rights to build 100 units prior to seeking this voluntary bonus, he would build subsequently 120 units. The 10% requirement, you see MPDU, and that you want to think moderately priced dwelling unit, that would result 10% of 120, so 12 units of his full density would be required as affordable units. Half of those would serve households with incomes below 75% of median income. Half would serve households below 90% of area median income, and each of those have different price levels that the homes have to be provided for. Just in terms of how we made that calculation and believe really that developers will actually do better if they take advantage of this, if you turn to Table 7, which is further up on that page, on page 26, what we did is we started with the median sales price that Kathy reported earlier for a household of four. If you look in that middle of that first column across the page, $326,000. And then we made adjustments, relatively minor adjustments, reflecting smaller household sizes as you go from a household or a housing unit that would be appropriate for a four-person family down to a single-person unit and up to as many as six people, how we would expect that median sales price to be adjusted. I'll say this is important because what we're calculating and what we're counting on is that developers want to build more units because they're able to sell additional units and earn profit on those additional units. What we're suggesting here is that some of those profits can in turn be used to make these homes affordable. And I'll continue through the table just to show how we did that calculation. After the median sales price, the next thing you see is the estimated cost to build. These are numbers that reflect our estimates of building a modest home, not perhaps a home that's built to current market standards, one perhaps without the granite counters and perhaps without the third bath and the fourth bathroom, but ones that are appropriate for working class people that want to live here in Newcastle County. And I'll say part of our assumption is you don't have the land cost for that unit because of the density bonus that's being conferred. So this is essentially bricks and sticks cost, development cost related to creating that home. The actual maximum sales price for what a household that is at 75% of median income can afford, though, is a little bit less than that, and you'll see that as it goes across the page. That's the next line down. $136,000 through $254,000, depending on the household size. What you see there at the bottom, and I'm going to say our supposition, is that a builder can build at that modest cost, but they're not able to get down to the full, I'll say, level of cost that is affordable by a family at 75% of median. Hence, there is a net outlay, if you will, that the builder would have to make in order for that to be workable. What we then say is, but on the other hand, he's building additional market units and is making profits on that. We believe in the profit motive, and we believe that's why inclusionary housing works around the country. Hence, in order to produce that write-down, what does he need in terms of an additional density bonus? And as you can see it going across the page, essentially, the required density bonus gets bigger as you get to the larger household sizes where the gap is greater, and you can see that difference, I think. The next table does essentially the same set of exercises with a unit that serves a household below 90% of area median income. And again, we think that the house price is going to be about the same. The maximum sales price goes up a bit because a family at 90% of AMI can afford a home that's a bit more expensive. And then, again, you see, in some cases, the parentheses indicates that the developer doesn't need a write-down to reach that level. And, in fact, that's the case in terms of how we've done these calculations. So there's offsetting bonuses, if you will, that he'll have a bonus that he doesn't need to fully utilize to bring down the price for the moderately priced dwelling units. And I just want to make sure people understand this. I'll say there are assumptions and suppositions that go into this table, but it's the kind of analysis we do around the country because we think it is important for developers, again, to at least be whole after they engage in this kind of program. They're providing an important community benefit. It's important that the community recognize that and work with them so that they're able to achieve a positive offset that helps the bottom line. The next table that I'll just flip over, but Kathy touched on our recommendation briefly, and we really do see this at this stage of Newcastle County's evolution. It really is a voluntary program. If the developer is satisfied with his current planning and the development by right, he doesn't have to, he's not required or would not be required with this legislation to produce additional affordable units. If, on the other hand, he likes the idea of the 20% density bonus, he's going to have to provide 10% of the total number of units. If he seeks a rezoning, and I think it's important to acknowledge that as rezonings are granted, there's really an important public conferral of benefits. I'll say that currently around the country, more and more ordinances are going towards an expectation that as public approvals are granted, as public infrastructure is put into the development pot, if you will, there's an expectation that it's reasonable to exact, and I think it's accurate to say it's an exaction, things that for public benefits that are needed in the community. This is typically called land value recapture, I'll say, in planning parlance. So as land value is conferred, as development density is greatly increased, the communities that are working with inclusionary programs are saying, but we've got a serious affordable need in our jurisdiction. We need to get some affordable units as part of your development in return for that conferral of a benefit. So just to turn over to page 27, I have to confess there's an error on the table, and I'll just walk you through that. This is the second example, which actually refers to a rezoning that would be a substantial rezoning. And what we said is it's a 100-unit subdivision to keep the math simple. If subsequent to the rezoning, it became a 200-unit subdivision, unlike what it says here, that's 100% increase in density. It's not a 50% increase in density, so I apologize for that. But what that means then is that you have 200 units. The developer would have doubled his density, and we're suggesting that in a density increase of that sort, they would have not a 10% requirement, but a 20% requirement. So in that 200-unit development, 40 of the units would be required to be affordable. The developer would still have 60 additional market rate units with which hopefully to make a profit and to help offset some of the costs of providing these affordable units. So that would be the calculation. Rather than 15 units serving households below 75% of area median income, there would be 20 units, and then also 20 units serving households below 90% of AMI. So that is the analysis that we did. No analysis is perfect in trying to suppose what a good public policy is, but I'll say this is not uncommon in terms of how this is approached around the country. Currently, we're working in Chicago and working in inside the loop, and they're going through a revamping of what's called the Affordable Requirements Ordinance in Chicago, and we're dealing not in additional units, but in additional floor area ratio as these skyscrapers are built there. And we're working with developers that have recognized the need for these affordable units. They're eager for the additional density, and we think that it's a good fit for Chicago. Clearly, Newcastle County has not yet experienced that kind of development, but I'll say that kind of development pressure. But I think this is a good model, and I think the key part is it really serves people that currently are priced out of the ownership market and out of the rental market here in Newcastle County. So we're happy. I think it's been a pleasure working with Kathy and Eileen to bring this forward. I fully expect that there'll be additional work as this legislation is introduced and evolved, and we hope to be able to work with you and bring that along. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Councilman Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, let me thank the Land Use Department and the sponsor for enabling County Council to consider these options. I have a couple of observations that I'd like to make. My experience that density bonus coupled with moderately priced inclusionary zoning off-site or on-site is established, proven, not only in other jurisdictions, but this as well. Early in my 18 years, I sponsored a 20% density bonus for what was then a very marketable segment, age-restricted housing. Now we boomers would rather live in a community where we can age in place with people of all generations. But that 20% density bonus enabled the market sector to be competitive, whereas before it wasn't, and it caused a great growth in that housing sector. Another project that I was able to benefit from was a project on a railroad track in Claymont, where we not only increased 2 DU per acre to 16 DU per acre, but we made commercial office and residential mandatory. It was a paradigm shift. And we had 20% inclusionary zoning, 10% on-site, 10% off-site. And that project went through, it takes decades for absorption. So there was an economic downswing, as we know, in 2007. But it's come through, and there's been investment of other amenities as well, and it's doing well. So this is not a foreign concept where we can say it only works elsewhere, it doesn't work here. It does work here, and that's proven. And I agree with you that the increased density should be coupled with public conferral of benefits, as you say, in the form, I would say, in the form of design guidelines. I would suggest, I don't know if that's what you meant or not, but exact was always a word as an attorney that I was afraid of, where I looked at voluntary assurances. But in this case, I think you could ask for a quid pro quo of quality of construction materials, architectural excellence, and intertwining the historic fabric of the surrounding community into the houses that are built. And that's what we did with the Claymont Renaissance. And density is desirable for some. We can say density is our friend. Now, we don't have the point where FAR is needed in this county. FAR calculation has been used by this county. We got away from it because we don't have those densities. But I'd like to see an opportunity to serve those communities where the institutional impediment of our Unified Development Code is one of the biggest impedance, along with the fire code, as it's interpreted, not as it's written, to encourage walkable, bikeable, mixed-use urbanity, where people move there not only because they're compelled to by their economic circumstances, but also because they choose to live there at that chapter in their life, whether they be new Americans, aging boomers, true elderly, and millennials. And those four sectors make up more than 50% of the population. But with tongue-in-cheek, you can go to jail for meeting that market need. And we need to make that paradigm shift. Thank you very much.
Councilman Powers.
Yes. You had said you were on Montgomery's County's Inclusionary Board, and I've got a question, and most of them, this is going to affect probably a lot of this, my district and Councilman Bell's, which is the rural area. And I know Montgomery has a really good TDR program that goes along with their inclusionary zoning, and I'm just wondering, how do you make that work into something like this? And the reason I'm saying is, I have no problem, affordable housing. But when you add, especially when you go and take 100 units across from, which was a field, and you add, they get 200 more units, and we're not preserving anything in my district, my constituents and Councilman Bells have a real problem with it.
I think that's one of the reasons why we are recommending that it's part of rezoning, only if you're going through a rezoning. And your established process of, you'd have to get through the rezoning process first, which I understand is somewhat of a public process with public comments taken into consideration. So you'd have to get through that process first before, and then it's only whatever the number of units you get approved through that rezoning process, then it's just to say a certain percentage of them have to be priced at a certain dollar amount. So it's not increasing it beyond what you normally would see through a rezoning.
You're not understanding what I said. I understand how rezoning goes. We've done a lot of them. The difference is my constituents, if I got 200 units over 200 acres, and now I got 400, and not preserving anything in my district, and the difference will be is you see how many are on council, but two of us are representing most of the area where most of the building. Our county grew, in his district and mine, our districts grew more than what the county population grew. We have two-thirds of the rest of the county is in my district and Councilman Bell's district. And right now, I can vote no all I want, and it could still go through. So what I'm saying is, for my area, they'd rather see something preserved out of it than adding more density by just it's still giving it to them.
Yeah, if I could comment on that, and I think you were touching on a program that's been longstanding in my home county, Montgomery County, the Transferable Development Rights Program, which is an agricultural preservation program that essentially allows the farmers who at one point had the ability to put one home on every 5 acres in Upper Montgomery County, and that would have happened in Montgomery County given its proximity to Washington, D.C. Rather than allowing that to continue, they actually changed the law so that there was one home for 25 acres, which was typically often used as a family home or something like that, where the rural character of the upper county would be preserved. And then 4 transferable development rights that could be sold by that farmer, that person who was keeping it in agriculture, to areas in what in Montgomery County is referred to as the Down County, which is the area closest to the District of Columbia. I think that's been a good program for Montgomery County. I think there's certainly development interests today that are still trying to open up. It's really the upper third of Montgomery County that's been put in this area of agricultural preservation. But the result is, and going back to the gentleman's comments earlier, it means that you have additional density in close proximity to the parts of Montgomery County where you've got mass transit, you've got the metro system, you've got the major employment opportunities, all of that. So it's a planning tool. It's not the one we're here to talk about, but I would discourage you from considering it.
I understand. It's not in this report. That's been, if you were here earlier with the plan that came through, I don't know if you were in here when we were talking about it just before you. I mean, we don't have enough funds to reserve in these areas, as Councilman Weiner said. And adding 100 more units, I don't care what you call it. I have a real problem with it. Just by rezoning it, you're giving it to the developer. And you can say whatever you want, but it doesn't take care of problems in my district.
Councilman Cartier?
Yes, thank you. First, I'd like to state that I agree wholeheartedly with the early comments that Councilman Hollins made about fair housing in Newcastle County, and I've been a very big supporter of trying to develop a program of inclusionary housing to address the housing needs of our residents in Newcastle County. I really believe that people who grew up here, work here, should be able to live here in decent, affordable housing. I'm just trying to put my heads around this new concept and try to understand how it's going to further that goal. And I think I'm seeing a kind of gap here between the kind of zoning code we have and what this will enable. Generally speaking, I don't know if you folks read the zoning code of Newcastle County. Were you able to study that in the course of your recommendations for this? That's my first question.
It was conversations with the land use staff.
Okay. We have a great amount of S-zone ground, which is very low density, nets out at 1.3 dwelling units an acre. The general rezoning that you would entertain for S would be to go to ST, which is not considered high density at all. I believe, and maybe someone from the Land Use Department can give me an idea of this, but I believe the ST will allow residential family homes in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 units an acre, maybe a little more than that. I'm not exactly positive about that. Do you believe, my question is, do you believe that if a developer is going to contemplate that rezoning process, which is really the ones that we encounter in terms of residential zoning here, S to ST, do you think that there are incentives in the moderately priced housing program that you've proposed that will want to induce a developer to go through that process?
Now, I'll say that I'm not intimately familiar with the particular zoning class that you're describing. I think if the outcome is, rather than building, and also you said 2 to 3 units per acre, they'll be able to build 6 units per acre. I think they will. I think one of the questions that I'm sure the council has to struggle with is, can that development be supported with public infrastructure? And I think that's an important consideration. It's very difficult to do affordable housing in very low density settings. Land costs too much. You've got to put, you know, your own well-built septic in on each lot. It's really an uneconomic prospect. So you've got to be able to do that kind of development in an efficient way. And so I think that's really the area that the Land Use Department is going to have to focus on, is which particular zones are going to be most amenable to this type of upzoning.
Councilman Howell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Councilman Cartier's point, I think is exactly the examples that are here in Newcastle County. The point that may be overlooked is that when we rezone from S to ST, it's not by right. So anytime a developer comes before Newcastle County for a rezoning, they're asking this government to give them density by fact of rezoning. There is no density bonus here. The whole idea is that if we're going to give developers the right to rezone, which they don't have, then there should be a public good. The public good would be to include houses that are affordable to a broader range of constituents. We're not giving up any density. The rezoning itself is where the density is captured. And if the density is 70% greater than the base density before rezoning, then it simply means that we're saying to the developer, as a matter of policy, you will include 20% affordability. If it's less than 70% of the previous area before the rezoning, then it's 15%. So it's a matter of a public good being served. There is no density bonus, and I think that's one of the features of the moderately priced development plan dwelling units, is simply because the issue that the public has really struggled with is the amount of density that the workforce housing would allow. That is no longer there. It's only there when there's a density bonus, when there's the land is already by right and there's no rezoning required, then we're saying 20%. So it's a really, really serious difference between what is currently allowed in the volunteer program, as it's called. But the fact of the matter is, even with the new program that says that if you're going to come for a rezoning, which is not by right, the policy is that you will be inclusive, is all that it says. It's not mandatory, simply because no one makes a developer come to the county council to ask for the rezoning. So the developer is asking for something, and we're asking the developer then to provide a public good, because once all the land is gone, all the land is gone.
If I could answer also the question of Councilman Cartier. When you go from S to ST, you have about between a 300% and 400% increase. You go from 1.3 dwelling units per acre to 5.4. So it's a very significant increase.
If I could, one moment. So you can achieve 5.4 dwelling units an acre with an ST zoning over S, which is 1.3. So you go from 1.3 to 5.4?
5.4, yes.
Okay.
Councilwoman?
Thank you. One of the issues that I had a problem with in the old workforce housing was the 15 years. I think I get both sides of this. I understand that 15 years keeps it affordable for that amount of time, but that was one of the reasons, that is one of the reasons why we're not selling the affordable units in the workforce housing developments that we now have, is because there are people that come to look at them and say, wait a minute, I just got married, I have no children, I can live in this size unit now, but by the time I have a few children, in 7 years, 8 years, I'm not going to want to live in this size as my kids get older, but now I'm stuck here because I don't get my total equity out of this property. So by keeping this at 15 years, this doesn't resolve the problem that I'm hearing is out there. It doesn't resolve the problem in my mind.
Let me clarify really what our recommendation is. We are recommending a 15-year price control. What we're also recommending is a system where, to the extent that a family chooses to move prior to that, that they'd be entitled to a CPI, consumer price index increment, each year that they live there. And the CPI is typically a fairly modest index. It typically goes up 2 to 3% now. So they get 2% based on their equity each year that they live there between 1 and year 15. To the extent they make physical improvements to the property, they finish a basement and put in a rec room, add a back porch, things of that sort, those costs, presuming they keep good records, would be able to be added to the sale price. So it's not intended to lock the price in at what it was at year one. It acknowledges that the market changes, people's incomes increase, all of that. The reason, though, to have a longer-term control really relates to, I think I heard Councilman, I want to say Penrose, I know that, say there's not, you know, the land is a finite resource. Right now, Newcastle County is growing fairly rapidly, but you'll reach a point where there's not that much land left to develop. And affordable housing will remain a continuing need at that point in time. Keeping the ability within that 15-year time frame for those homes to be resold and serve additional families and households that need it is really, it's a balance. And also, all around the country, this is an issue that communities struggle with. They want to see equity built up by the family that has a chance to buy this home. This allows for a moderate amount of equity to be developed, but it also recognizes the fact that this home wouldn't exist but for the public benefit that's been conferred. And when, particularly when moderately priced homes are in expensive marketplaces, that can mean really a windfall profit when that family turns around and sells it without a price control. And that very much undermines the ordinance in the sense of, you know, the validity of it in other people's eyes. Somebody got a windfall because they were able to get this great home in Green Acre Farms. They lived there for 5 years, turned around and sold it. Because that school district is so remarkable, they sold it for $300,000. And that really has the effect of undermining public trust in, you know, the value that's being conferred, the increase in density.
And again,
so it's a balance that needs to be struck.
You know, again, we came from a system where we probably had 11 residential categories down to basically what we have 4, and but reserve is not really a category. So we're probably looking at 2, S and ST. You know, if we had categories that gave more density, we wouldn't need, even though we would have to have some sort of program, we would have the density to have more affordable housing, which would, you know, put more money into the sewers. We wouldn't be running a sewer line for a minimum number of houses. We would be running it for more houses, so we would be then taking in the money from that sewer line. I'm looking around here today, and I'm concerned that there's nobody in this room. And I don't know what that means. I thought we were going to be in this room because I know that emails were going out, you know, to different builders and people associated with that community, that they needed to be here today to discuss this. And frankly, I see one person that I know that's representing a law firm. Got a lot of county people here. I mean, what are we talking here? Are they liking this so they're not showing up? They've seen it. They know what's coming, so they're okay with it. Or are they just saying, hey, we're never going to use this, so why bother? And that concerns me more than any of the discussion going on here today, because normally in a discussion like this, we would have 100 people in this room.
Yeah, I don't really know, and I'm sure there's other people that could opine on the folks who are here and the folks who are not here. But I'll say that I think, and I think from our conversations with Eileen, rezonings are a significant part of the development activity here in Newcastle County. To the extent that this applies to those rezonings, and that's the intention, it will have an effect. I couldn't project the outcome in terms of units, and certainly there's other changes that the county can make, that, as you're suggesting, to add density in particular places that will also produce affordability. This isn't meant, I think, to avoid the need to make other changes.
You know, back when we first started with the UDC, we talked so much about anti-sprawl, and yet we created a zoning booklet that created McMansions on minimum half-acre lots. In my mind, we created more sprawl. We went, you know, what Councilman Powers was talking about, Councilman Bell talks about all the time, that, you know, they were moving further and further throughout the county. Good or bad, we have pushed people out from the infrastructure that we have, so with the UDC that is currently in place. I don't know that this is helping.
Councilman Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point that Councilwoman Kilpatrick has made, I know she's made it before, I think one of the fundamental reasons why we didn't have people to buy into the workforce housing program is simply because people could buy a house considered workforce at $346,000. So the price point of the workforce house is greater than the market. So who would enter into an agreement for a 15-year residency when they can afford to buy a house for less than the workforce house? That becomes a critical point. Right. Also becomes a critical point why we don't have a waiting list, because the way the housing legislation and workforce is crafted, when you say 120% or 90%, that's what you mean. You don't have a range. With the new, whether the development community is here or not, they will be here when they come for a rezoning. This is not tied to anything other than the fact that if you're going to ask for a rezoning, you don't get any density. You're just serving a public good because you are getting the rezoning. Now, if they're not here today, maybe they won't ever come because they will never go through a rezoning. If they're going to go through a rezoning, they will be here. And this policy would be the part of the rezoning process. It's nothing outside of that except for the few parcels that are already by right. Rezoning is not by right. If you come for a rezoning, then it means that once you go through that process, you are required to be inclusive. It's nothing more complicated than that. It doesn't give you any more than what the rezoning will allow you to have.
Councilwoman.
And I think that's my point. I don't know what that community is thinking. I would like to know what the building community is thinking at this point. I mean, looking at this, I know I'm going to come for a rezoning. Do I feel like this is a punishment because I now have to do something that I didn't really want to do in a rezoning? And is that going to just keep us all in S zone for however long because people aren't going to want to do that? I mean, I don't know how many people you talk to that were, or how many people are interested or looking at what you're writing in your ordinance, but we are a depressed county. And I don't think that we can afford to slow down or stop development. I mean, as one of the other councils said to me, not too long ago, is we haven't approved anything over 20,000 square feet in the last 2 years. We don't have a good growth plan at this point. We are not attracting businesses. Every report that you read puts Newcastle County as a non-business friendly atmosphere, and I think we're seeing that in who's not coming. I was in Wisconsin, which was in an industrial town over the weekend, which is was an extremely depressed town throughout this recession, and the amount of building of factories and warehouse businesses and Amazon huge buildings is amazing. You go down 94 and both sides are brand new, not glorious buildings necessarily, but functional big buildings hiring a lot of people. I'm not seeing that here, and we're the East Coast. You know, that's where I would expect to see it coming back, is from the coast making it to the Midwest. It made it to the Midwest and we don't have it. So my concern is that the more pressure we put on any one community to not do something unless you're willing to go with a plan that we say you have to go with, which may not be what they want to do, is that they're going to stop building. Sussex County hasn't stopped building. People are telling me we're not putting up with it, with what the Land Use Department is here, and we are moving on. We're still building, but we're building in another county. And I don't know, I'm sure that those counties have inclusionary housing somehow. I don't necessarily know how that is, but I don't know that I'm comfortable with the attachment to a rezoning.
If I could just very quickly respond. First of all, in terms of development itself, our development numbers are up not only over last year but the year before. We're seeing them in different categories. We're seeing a lot of rental apartment, so we're seeing that's where the current pressure is. Secondly, this certainly is no intention to deal, nor would it deal in any way with any of the jobs-related efforts. All the efforts in what was presented to council a couple of weeks ago for streamlining are to make sure that we do not have the hurdles, including many hurdles which add over a year to any of the commercial, job, industrial applications. With that said, the question is this. There are two issues that you brought up. One is we have very limited number of districts. I think that's an issue as we go forward. Many people have talked to me about it. Residents have concerns about it because they don't like a CR covers everything.
Right.
Business people also have a concern about it because it's unless you have one of the higher, like a CR, you're very restricted. There's simply not enough range. The second issue that's a very, very legitimate issue that's got to be addressed as we go forward with the comprehensive zoning ordinance. But then the second issue has to do with the rezonings themselves. I have heard some very positive things, several of the people in the audience I've heard from and have been very positive. I've heard some negative things from some residents, particularly in a couple of areas south of the canal. From the home builders who and the real estate people who and some of the engineers and developers that we had in the couple of focus groups, we've generally heard positive things because it's a fairly straightforward approach. I have from a couple of the land use attorneys, and then they have indicated other developers who are interested in rezonings believe that not that it would be more expensive, which it would not be, and not that it isn't a fair and equitable approach, but that it may make it harder to get a rezoning. So those are the combinations. We've heard home builders are very different from developers and attorneys. That's the breakdown.
Councilor Street.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not looking for responses, and I don't want folks to feel like I'm blindsiding them or attacking them. I just want everybody to know what my concerns are. And my concerns are several. One, I'll start with the issue of the 15 years and concerns other folks have made. And to me, it's actually punitive to put folks in this program and say that you can't benefit from the equity in your house like everybody else. That's a concern. Second, I'm concerned, and you know, folks on this council here now, members of this council, and folks previous have been, well, they're pro-developer. Well, somebody better be concerned about the developer, because we're not going to be able to sustain the services that we have at the level that we have unless we generate some new revenue. And the only way we're going to generate new revenue is there has to be growth, or you'll have to raise taxes in a way that nobody wants to do. So their input and their concern should not be considered. Third, I don't think it's a good idea to just isolate one particular policy and let that stand alone when you should have a comprehensive housing plan. And the comprehensive housing plan needs to look at housing at all levels. And this, as far as I'm concerned, is at the top level. And concerns I have that I expressed at the last committee meeting, if you look at the library report that was just submitted, Route 9 corridor in my district, outside the city, median income is $48,000. That means all the working folks there don't qualify, don't benefit. There's no hope whatsoever for them going into this. In the view that, well, one size doesn't fit all and everybody's not going to benefit from it. Problem I have with that is, I have folks sleeping on the street. Go down the street right now, eight blocks, turn left, there are folks sleep in front of the train station waiting to get an admission because they want to make sure they get in there on time. If you look at the lunch line from the mission, it goes two blocks down to Walnut Street, down to our Lancaster Avenue, and it's getting longer every day. So while we're addressing the upper income, my question is still going to remain, what are we going to do in terms of housing? And all those folks down there at that mission didn't originally come from Wilmington. And there's representation from most of the districts here in this room right now. So we got a homeless problem. So what's our priority going to be? Where are we going to spend revenue? And how are we just going to make affordable housing really affordable? Because you can call it workforce housing, moderately priced housing. The predominance of folks who live in this county can't afford it and won't benefit from it one iota. The other concern I have is we're talking about inclusion. I got data here. If anybody wants to look, that's not my data, school data, because that's where I find things. But the growth area in the county has been in Smyrna School District, Appaquinimic School District. If you look at those schools, you know, basically Appaquinimic's gone from around 5,000 to 9,000 in the last 10 years. The district, the student population is 25% African American, essentially, 4% Hispanic, 27% low income. Well, who's being excluded and who do you want to include? If you look at Smyrna, the same thing. The data is almost the same, except Smyrna High School, 50% low-income students. So I don't know who's being excluded, how you prove that. So what are we fixing this broke? And the other is, if you're going to have this kind of policy comprehensive, you need to look at the adjacent jurisdictions, because you don't want the developers to say, well, I don't want to do this, and I'm not going to do it in Newcastle County, so I'll just walk over the line and do my development in Kent County. There needs to be at least a conversation with adjacent jurisdictions in terms of how this is going to interact and positively interact or negatively interact, and at least be able to make that assessment. So, you know, I supported this initially.
out of the respect and the passion that Councilman Hounds has for the issue, still has for the issue, and I don't want to say no at this point, because anytime you have an opportunity to get folks in housing, you need to do that. But at this point, I have those concerns, and they're legitimate and serious concerns. And I'm going to tell you right now, when it comes to resources, my priority is always going to be to get folks off the street from sleeping first, and not last year, not last month, last week. My family service workers come to me and said, Mr. Street, two placements, emergency, need of emergency shelters. There were no shelters in New Castle County. Those folks got placed in Dover. Not because we're not doing it, but we provide the slots. All the shelters are full. What's our priority going to be? And if it can be everything, that's fine. But if it can't be all, then I think those who are under that income of $70,000 that we're starting with need to be given priority. Folks sleeping on the street needs to be given priority. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Councilor Cartier.
I know it's getting late. I just want to reiterate, you know, my support for trying to develop a program for inclusionary housing in this county, and I take Councilman Holland's efforts as you know, being very true to that cause as well, and I want to be supportive of this. I guess my last thought goes to the issue of rezonings, and believe me, I think it's fair on a rezoning where you're proposing to take someone's bronze. If you go to the Olympic medal analogy, I've got a bronze piece of land here with a kind of development potential, and you're going to turn it into gold. Yes, I believe to extract, you know, public benefit from that process, it's fair for the government. I can tell you that, you know, when I've gone through rezonings in my district now, it hasn't necessarily been this kind of situation, but in other situations, I've always been cautioned, you know, you cannot condition rezonings. You know, there's no conditions. They have to be, you know, voluntarily entered into. So I would just like, for my sort of comfort level, to have a legal verification that we can tie, you know, an S to an ST rezoning and the density that you get taking that land from bronze and making it into gold, that we can, in fact, command and demand and require this kind of program. And just for my own comfort level, in terms of the legal issues, of course, everything can be litigated. This is America. But, you know, just for my own comfort that, you know, in fact, given Delaware law, that this is a something that can be legally required. I'm sure that you probably have done some of that work, and I just would like to have that confirmed for my comfort level. Thank you.
If I could just, and the answer is yes, we have, and yes, we will confirm something, MJ. I'll talk with MJ tomorrow. Just to answer one of the numerous ideas that Councilman Street raised, is part of this also includes trust funds. In other words, if you are in the moderately priced dwelling unit ordinance, if you are in a rezoning, you also have a requirement for trust funds, as we do today. And the trust funds go to community services, and again, I would probably agree that there needs to be a comprehensive approach as to how those trust funds are used, but those trust funds are, those additional funds which would come from this program, should certainly be used to address the kind of issues raised. Thank you.
Councilman Weiner.
Thank you. I just wanted to make some additional observations. I hope that we can increase densities. I know that folks are scared about density because we hadn't received a quid pro quo quality of architectural excellence and design. But as we get more dense, we can't pay for transit unless you've got that density. I mean, that's an obvious statement. Statistically speaking, you pay for one bus in the morning and one bus in the afternoon with 60 use per acre. If you want a multitude of schedule, which is what a normal community needs 7 days a week, you need a minimum of 10 to 12 DUs per acre. So our goal ought to be even greater density. And development doesn't fit everywhere. And some folks will prefer to pay for the McMansion out in the middle of the countryside. But for so many years, the rest of us have underwritten that dysfunctional model. And we can't afford to do that anymore. We don't live in the Wild West. Land is not unlimited. So as we finally made that recognition, I like your program because it recognizes that you don't want to allow folks to take advantage of the inclusionary zoning by selling it at the market. There's a trade-off, so I like the idea under the 15-year price control of adjusting it to the CPI and home improvements. I think it's a good balance. You're going to need to demonstrate support from the development community so they feel it's the density bonuses are sufficient incentivization, and that's got to be shown here to the council members. I've seen this work elsewhere in my leadership role with the National Association of Counties Energy, Environment, and Land Use Steering Committee. I've seen it work here on the two examples I gave. And I think you see a thoughtful council that are asking questions that need to be answered. But I took the time this weekend to read the whole report and the ordinance, and I hope their questions will get answered because I'm excited about this opportunity.
Councilman Sheldon.
Yeah, just real quick. What is the maximum dwelling units per acre that you're coming up with the workforce housing?
We haven't calculated that. That's I think that's going to be a feature of whatever zone the development occurs in and the increment in density that's requested under our rezoning. So we've not tried to say that's the 10 units to the acre or 50 units, and certainly you're going to have a variety of settings throughout the county where you're going to go from probably at least part apartment density up, you know, out to estate lot kind of density. So it's going to vary.
Okay. But, yeah, I was just, ST now is 5.4. We do know that. If we go from S to ST. That was stated here earlier. I guess the question that I'm trying to get my hands around is, what makes a developer do this on his own to be able, when he's been doing 5.4? I mean, we can say we're building more than we did. That's only because in 08, 09, and 010, we approved over 100-some plans. We've canceled land use like 3 out of the last 6 months. You don't build if you're not having meetings. So the question is 3 years from now is when this hits. And this is when the law comes in effect and so forth. And I think it's very important for me to understand is how does this make a developer want to do this?
That's a great question. And I've been saying since, I'll say 2007. There hasn't been a whole lot of ambition on the part of the development community for the national reasons that, you know, I'm sure you've seen in the numbers here in New Castle County have hit this county as far as anywhere. Part of what is obviously, you know, the calculus that the developer and the home builder have to make is there a market for the home that I'm going to build? I'm taking a risk, and it's a real risk that has to be recognized as you're purchasing. But currently, I'll say, and based on, you know, what Eileen has shared with us, there's a resurgence of development interest and activity happening in the county. As you heard her say, it's more on the rental side, and that's what we're also seeing nationally. A lot of people who lost homes in the recession, who were foreclosed on, can't qualify now to buy a home, and so there's not the strength in the home buying market. I think part of what is going to, you know, that's a, it's an individual question for each developer, but part of what I think is a value that an inclusionary program offers is that you create home buyers at different economic levels by giving them a good product, a home that fits into the community, that is, you know, in a safe neighborhood, a place where there's jobs nearby and a healthy environment to raise their family. And it's helpful from the development community's perspective. And I've heard home builders have said this to me. If I've got somebody who buys a townhouse from me, and subsequently their family grows, their kids go away to school, they decide they need, you know, a bigger home or they want to downsize, I've got somebody who, A, recognizes the value that my product provided them initially, they'd like to continue, and they've got roots in the community. If the community doesn't have those kind of options, if essentially it starts at the median income and goes up from there, you have to say, where are the move-ups? And so I think that's one aspect of it. But I would say, you know, and I'm sure you appreciate it as well, when a developer makes that investment, he looks at his bottom line. He's in business to make a profit, and should be. And they've got to take a whole lot of factors into consideration as they do that.
One more quote.
What we're trying to create is something that offers an offsetting value, that is the bonus, or the intermittent density granted by rezoning. It'll be probably a little bit of trial and error to see who bites and who says, that's not for me. I will say major national developers, major national home builders are very familiar with this kind of program and operate them, you know, throughout the country.
Oh, sure. And they build 20-30% of the homes nationwide anyway, so more so in Delaware, I bet you the percentage is higher. The other question was, did in your research, and I don't know if you were commissioned to do this, the existing homes for market value. I just, for the heck of it, because my daughters were home, went to Newark, the city of Newark, and Williamsburg Village, actually. Ms. Diller knows about it. I was very surprised. The townhomes, there's only two bedrooms, two bath, or one and a half bath. Definitely a starter home, but it was $105,000. And it was a decent working class community. And then when I was reading the ordinance, I was trying to put them together, and I'm saying I would try to go with an existing home. Of course, I know kids of daddy want to live next to their doctor today, not tomorrow, today. And go from there. But I was just wondering if that was in any consideration of this, and if not, then it's a moot point.
Well, I'll say certainly the existing homes, housing stock is an important consideration, and I think if you read the report, you'll see we have the values for existing homes in addition, and they're substantially less than the new home market. I think part of the question really goes back to the Councilman's opening statement. You're giving people choices, and going back to that comment about affirmatively furthering fair housing, you want to give them choices throughout Newcastle County, ideally, because partly, and sometimes it may be the case that the older, less expensive housing is in areas where poverty tends to be concentrated,
right,
and minorities tend to be concentrated. And it's better if people have a chance to move out to integrate communities, and they've got good choices where the schools might be better, for example.
Oh, no doubt. No argument. We need something. I'm not arguing. I'm just trying to, like I said, grasp what the end result is in here. So, thank you.
Councilman Hollins.
I would just like to say that, again, that the inclusionary zoning does not contribute to density. The rezoning is what contributes to the density. Inclusionary zoning has nothing to do with the number of houses that's going to be built or how many per acre. That's all contained in the rezoning process. If you go from S to ST, that means that you're going to increase the density by fivefold, with or without inclusionary zoning. Inclusionary has nothing to do with the number of houses that you're able to build. That's all contingent upon the rezoning process. And if I'm hearing that the developers in Newcastle County are not going to build in Newcastle County simply because they may be required to have of all this density that they're going to receive in the rezoning process, this government is not willing to set aside or to include 15% of that density to moderately priced housing, then it's hard for me to understand just what are we all about. Are we saying that our role here as Newcastle government is driven solely by the market? That's what investors do. We are the government here. We have people, I can imagine, if you said to a senior citizen who's trying to get into one of our high-rises, is that the market is going to take care of you. If we say to the folk who've been on Section 8 for the last 3 or 4 years, because now we don't even, we've closed, shut it down, that the market is going to take care of you. It seems to me that the discussion is going toward what the market is going to do. The market doesn't have a conscience. We have a responsibility here as the government. If we're so afraid that developers who come forth before this county government to use up all the land to build houses and get a rezoning without a public good, that that's okay, that we should not require a developer who's coming forward who wants a rezoning, that we should not suggest to them that we're concerned about moderate income people in this government and we're afraid that now they're going to stop doing rezonings. They're not going to go from S to ST simply because of all this additional density that they're going to get. They're going to refuse to provide for moderately priced housing. Is that what we're afraid of? I mean, that to me is really not a government that I would be proud of. I just have to clearly state that, that we're so concerned that somehow they're going to run to Chester County or Delaware County simply because there is inclusionary zoning in Newcastle County, Delaware, when there's inclusionary zoning in Palm Beach County, Florida, and some of the most affluent jurisdictions in this nation, there is inclusionary zoning. It has nothing to do with additional density, and I think that's one of the beauties about the recommended legislation is does not add any additional density. That's all tied to the rezoning. So if we're willing to give a developer a rezoning from S to ST without having any policy associated with that, with moderately income people, and right today, in a global sense, first-time home buyers are not entering into the marketplace. All of the action in the marketplace has been through refinancing. So if you're concerned about the economy of this jurisdiction, and everybody knows that first-time home buyers are the ones who move the economy, and we're not willing to give them an opportunity, then I think we have been very short-sighted here and not looking at a larger picture and just assuming that somehow the market is going to take care of everybody. And this seems to me to be a more market-driven discussion than it is a discussion of all this is inclusion, not expansion, inclusion. I rest my case.
Thank you. Okay, Councilman Warren, let's call the night after this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to applaud Councilman Hollins for a very logical, cohesive presentation. And just for what it's worth, add my two cents to that. The communities that are strongest are the ones that integrate all socioeconomic classes together. For us, right now, we've de facto segregated the worker bees from the wealthier. We want to make sure that, you know, 10 to 15% of every community has an option to include those that have more modest income. And then the high tide raises all the boats. Everyone should have an opportunity to partake in the increases that over time homes with their ups and downs tend to bring folks up. And we're only as strong as our weakest link. So we have to recognize that those that provide the jobs as janitors or less economic remunerative jobs are part of our community, so they're not driving on the roads from some other county to get here, which is exactly what statistics show right now, that Newcastle County and Wilmington have the jobs, and we as a government have let that sector down. They're clogging our roads to drive here because they've got to go live in Kent County or some other place that has housing that's less expensive. And also, we have this fear of density. And it's understandable to an extent because we let folks that don't understand or intuitively build quality to give density a black eye. But density is our friend. And through rezonings, we can provide further incentives. But setting that aside, we have a moral and legal obligation as a government to do some social engineering. Government has its place, and this is certainly our role.
Okay, we're going to go to the public. Public have anything to say?
Sure. I'm afraid to give you mine. This is the only one.
Get around.
But what I can do is have my aides. I think I'll be as okay, 4 or 5.
Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. Thank you, Councilman Hollins, for your work on this. I did have my name is Paul Calistro. I'm, among other things, the director of a not-for-profit development corporation and have worked in the last 15 to 20 years in affordable housing, so I have a little bit of expertise, certainly not as much as the folks that are at this table. I think that from a general perspective, a couple of answers to the question, where are all the people, I really don't think they knew about tonight's meeting. So that's my general response to you. And I'm not faulting anyone. I'm just saying I don't think our community, the development community, the not-for-profit development community really was aware, and it's only because I received the phone call last night that I'm here. So if you want more public comment, you may have to do this again and advertise it a little more. Secondly, I think what we're seeing is an improvement over what you have right now, because what you have right now isn't working. Is it perfect? No, I think there's some assumptions in here I question. It's heading in the right direction. I applaud the work. Some of the assumptions that, you know, I want to point out to the council, and I don't want to lecture, but so if we look at Table 7, which talks about income levels and sales prices, when you're looking at the maximum sales price, and that's $231,275, I'm assuming that's no debt. That calculation was based on a family of four with no debt and a very high credit score. Because the market right now, in my opinion, is more like 130 to 160, because most of our residents have debt. And, you know, it's very hard to finance folks right now. We're still in a bad market. So, you know, you're really going to see numbers more in the area of 130 to 160 at the entry level for affordable housing for 75%. That's my professional opinion, but I didn't make the charge. So, and I think the second thing you need to understand is with today's market, say we use the $231,000 calculation, the buyer would have to come to the table because pretty much is going conventional right now with $50,000 of savings. So you need to take that into consideration when you're looking at how much stimulation you're going to have. And I think the last piece is you want to design something that's going to have some resiliency in the market when it shifts up and down. So I think you're taking the right approach. I personally think 15 years is too long. As a affordable housing provider, 15 years is reasonable in a booming market. It's not so reasonable in a flat market. And there are risks. The average family stays in a residency for about 7 years. So perhaps a little bit more generous. If you're going to go 15 years, a more generous prorated approach to recovering some of your investment, I think, is appropriate, because remember, buyers still have choices. They may not have a lot of choices, but if I can buy a home somewhere else that's perhaps not new, or I have to have a 15-year restriction in which I have the possibility of no equity, that's going to be, it is a tough sell. I've been selling those for years. I think the magic number is somewhere between 7 and 10 from a market perspective, not from a preservation perspective. Thank you for allowing my comments.
Mr. Chair, question of the
commenter.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. They're very helpful to us. I wish there were more folks here, Mr. Calistro, with your involvement and expertise. My experience across the country is that the control period is 5 years, 7 years, 10 years most. And, you know, I would ask that our folks who are the architects of this and our land use department take a look at retooling it, and the sponsor as well, for a shorter period. And not to say that I wouldn't support it at 15, but that was the one reservation that I had.
So may I respond? And then may I respond? So Delaware was, for a long period of time, generally using through Delaware State Housing Authority and the Federal Home Loan Banks financing a 5 to 7 year period. When the market got hot and folks were realizing a lot of equity, we went to 10 and then 15 years. You know, I think in the current market, you're absolutely correct that, you know, that number has to drive down in order. We can get folks to build these. The question is, can they, will the market absorb them? And I think, you know, with all the restrictions we currently have, you may want to consider looking at that. So I agree with that, but there was comments.
Councilman?
I guess my question, and I've thought about this, and we've talked about this before, but I think that you pretty much brought it up. When we look at the price of these houses, I still don't consider this affordable housing. I have a daughter, you know, out of college, could not afford some of what's here, married, two kids, not a wonderful income necessarily, but they couldn't afford what's on here. They have actually bought a conventional house with an FHA loan, a regular, you know, not a workforce housing or affordable house, with FHA, and that was the only way that they were able to do it to get the size that they needed with two kids. I don't know that, and maybe this goes more to the consultants, that have we looked at these numbers in comparison to real bank loans, what the real, you know, you come in with, oh, here's $47,000 a year. What is that bank going to give you as far as the mortgage goes? I mean, I know when we were getting mortgages, you know, it was like 2.5 to 3 times your income. 3 times the income of $47,000 does not come up to the price of these houses, and the people that are first-time home buyers or need to go into this program aren't going to have $50,000 as a down payment.
So I'm sorry. Sure. I didn't know if the question was to me or the consultant.
It was to whoever, I guess.
Could you go to the microphone?
I would like to make a comment about the whole issue of the relationship with the requirement for residency. If you look at the study, it's clear that compared to the study and the jurisdictions that are currently have inclusionary zoning, that we're at the low end. Most jurisdictions are around 30, 50 years, and some 99 years. So we can politically change that if you, according to the study, not according to what I think or according to what nostalgia says, but according to the study, we're at the low end. Now, other people may have other personal experiences, but based upon the study, 15 years is at the low end. The program is based upon the 75% and 90% of AMI for our area, unlike the 120 before, and there's a range here now. The other thing is that, and I think it's been said before, that we do have in Newcastle County a housing strategy. It's not just this one particular moderately priced housing program. If you were to look at Bayberry, and I think all of the folk who look at these communities from community services has said to us over and again,
the rentals in Bayberry are unaffordable to most people. They're affordable to some people because they're living there. That's why we're now looking at 90% in pricing the houses at 80%, so there would be a range. So we're taking that into consideration. Aside from that, I believe Bayberry has already contributed over $250,000 to the housing trust fund that would be used to help those people who are not able to ever own a house. And by the time Bayberry is done, it would be over $1 million to the housing trust fund. The reality is, not just here in Newcastle County, but across this country, what is going on, the discussion that I had last week coming back from the Congressional Black Caucus, is a national epidemic with access to capital, which is beyond our controls. What you realize is now with the Federal Home Finance Agency, who's now headed by Mel Watt, there's been discussion in Congress, there's bills in Congress to try to release some of the access to capital in order to for folk to be able to get houses now where they can, right now, the market, if you get 16%, they're not gonna actually give you a mortgage. That is a national problem, which has nothing to do with the program that we're trying to put in place. Once what the feds are saying now, just last night I heard that FHFA is going to deal with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and whatever these places are called that deal with the finances to make certain that they're going to loosen the restrictions that was a result of the housing crisis. That's a nationwide issue. Now, people cannot get mortgages, especially millennials. So that is a problem, and there will be houses on the market that are affordable to, I guess, every housing group. The idea here is that as we are using up all the land and building new developments, we want to be able to make certain that there is an opportunity for inclusion throughout Newcastle County. And if we don't have some mechanism in place, it simply means that we're going to segregate people by economics, because there will always be some place for somebody to buy a house for $100,000 or $150,000. Is that what we want? What we want, the idea for me, is that going forward, as we're using the land, that we're going to be certain that it's going to be inclusive of a certain range of incomes, that they're not relegated to houses in certain geographic areas of Newcastle County. And that's all I think we're trying to do here. It's not a catch-all. It's not going to have everybody in part of this piece of legislation, but the other pieces of legislation that we considered the HIP program, which is part of the housing strategy here. We have the housing trust fund, which is part of the housing strategy here. We have the in-law suites that we called whatever they were called. Accessory dwelling. We've gone through all of those programs. So this is not the only program, but this program is a program simply about inclusion. You would not use all the land in this county to build for a certain market and that market only. That's all we're trying to achieve here.
Thank you. Yeah, excuse me, Councilman. Yeah, I've been sitting here listening to this, and Councilman Street and I come from the same area in the city. And Paul Calistro here has built a lot of homes in the city. It's not that we want to knock down the new homes and not build them, but it's the fact that there's a lot of homes that are standing right now that are on the market that are affordable. Right. And we should be including them in our program. Right. Not only the new homes. I know everybody wants a shiny new car, shiny new shoes, and shiny new home and all that, but it's what you can afford. We don't have the people out there with the money that can afford $200,000-some homes. They can afford, what Paul said before, $130,000 to $160,000-some. And we should be looking at that and include that in our program. And we're not. We should be doing that. But at the same time, to build the homes that can be affordable for the people that can afford the $130,000-$160,000 homes, not the $200,000-$300,000, which I think is a stupid price for low-cost housing.
And it's all based on the economy. If you can build a house for $130,000 today,
for them, yes.
Right. The point is that when you look at the reality here is that there are certain income groups in this county that is dependent upon subsidies. Those subsidies exist through other housing programs.
Right.
So when you look at building new homes, you can exclude them, and you would never have inclusion. But the reality is that there are certain people that are between those folk that are being subsidized and those people that are making top salaries. So what do you do about moderately income earners here in Newcastle County? That's what this program is addressing, moderately income people in Newcastle County. It's not forgetting the people that are sub-moderate, but these are the people that also need help, middle-income wage earners who cannot necessarily afford $300,000 or $400,000 that we were building here in Newcastle County prior to workforce housing. The houses were at $400,000.
Right.
So you bring the houses down some to allow for those people to have an opportunity to move in other areas of Newcastle County. There will always be, as some of the pundits will tell you, well, they can all live in Wilmington, or they can all live on Route 9. That is not where we're trying to get to. We want to have a diversity of neighborhoods throughout the county, and we'll have a stronger county and a stronger economy.
Yeah, it's not what I was referring to, but what I was referring to, you know, there are certain areas of the city that not too far from where Councilman Street and I live.
Yeah.
If you go a few blocks from where we live, the homes are almost the same price as where we live. You go two or three blocks down from that, the same type of homes are $300,000 or $400,000.
Exactly.
And they're no different than the ones that we lived in. And
That's your point.
It's just that what do they want to include, you know, in demand? Councilman Street, sorry, go ahead.
No, I just want to say, Paul, I appreciate you being here, and you're my expert. And I know right now the folks that come in my center that are working full-time, that want to be first-time home buyers. You're the person, the primary person that's taking care of them, and you've worked your, I'm on council floor, you've worked real hard, and I appreciate you, respect your work, and it's not fair to ask you to help us with this, but any assistance that you could give in this process, I truly appreciate. And your expertise is recognized nationally better than it's recognized locally, which I have a problem with that, but I'm aware of it. I appreciate and respect it, and really, really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. And just my comment, again, this is an improvement over what we currently have. You know, that's what I want to say, and I appreciate the work going on. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. You know, nothing's perfect, but it is an improvement.
Councilwoman?
Just a clarification. When we put money into this trust fund, I mean, we talked about maybe are you going to be putting in $1 million. What ultimately are we using that money for? You know, are we helping people with down payments? Are we giving mortgages? I don't know what we do with it.
That's an internal question. We have legislation here in Newcastle County that is down payment settlement help program, legislation I passed way back when. We use monies from CDBG federal dollars to build Mansion Park on Route 9. I went to the private sector, and we're still using that money today as a revolving fund for down payment settlement help that I was able to get one of the banks to provide to Newcastle County that we're using still here today. The trust fund that was adopted, I believe, in 2008 or 9 has not seen any real monies because we haven't been building any houses. So I mentioned Bayberry because Bayberry is probably the largest contributor to the trust fund to date because it's probably the largest development that has come online. As we move forward, as the market come along, that's when we will have trust fund dollars to deal with some of the agencies, such as what Paul does, some of the agencies that's interfaith housing, where we use home funds and interfaith to go out to leverage that money with the state to provide for low-income housing. That's what the trust fund will do. It would match up with those organizations like Interfaith, and I think they were here earlier today. That's what the trust fund does. It provides for low-income housing. We're talking now about moderate income. We have low income, so we're talking moderate income. It's completely two different programs altogether. So once the trust fund, once activity begins in Newcastle County, you will see the trust fund begin to grow. It hasn't grown because we have not had activity here.
So everybody that builds under a rezoning with the moderate housing program will also be required to put money into the trust fund to help with
low income. Yes.
So it has nothing to do with the program that they're in. It's helping another program.
It's helping another program. That's the way the workforce housing legislation is written, and that's what is recommended for the new legislation, that the fees remain identical to what we already have. So you would still be a benefit to low-income folk who are not moving into Bayberry or any other
right, development. Right, to go for something else.
To go for low-income.
It doesn't matter where, as long as they fit the program.
For low-income is what it's designed for.
If the chairman has to go,
Councilman, can you take over?
I have some.
No, we all have to go.
Well, it's.
We all have to get out of here.
Yeah, I understand.
They got the planning.
Why is it when I raise my hand, all
okay,
of the
that's what I wanted to say. They got the planning board coming in.
Who's coming in?
Wilmington Planning Board has to be in here
by 6. Well, I have a question.
So we have to get out of here. So you got to make your questions quick.
Yes.
And sure.
Okay. I want to ask this of Paul Calistro. Penrose and you both made good questions, and there's a counterbalance. Now, what Penrose is saying is a very good point, and that is we need to keep affordable housing stock in the market rather than, you know, just enriching a few, if you can use that term, and then we run out of land. Now, Paul, you made a good point, too. You know, we're in a down market, so 15 years is long. Now, you heard Penrose make his point. My major question is right now, Paul, because, you know, I have a lot of trust in you, how do you respond to Penrose's very valid point?
So it's two issues. One is, and I think Penrose is right from the long perspective. If we're going to look at it from the long perspective, you know, permanent affordable housing, he's correct. What I'm suggesting to you, just pointing out to you, is that in the short term, over the next 2 or 3 years, you're not going to see, because of the market conditions, a lot of demand, as much demand as you might hope for this product. And so if buyers have choices in limited finance with a 15-year restriction, it's a tough sell to developers, and it's in the current market. That's my point.
And the other clarification I wanted to get from you, it's my experience that you only have 7 to 10 to 15 years on restrictions. I think what Penrose was talking about with the 99 years, our whole communities like Vail and Aspen and Arden, you don't have that in a inclusionary zoning realm. And maybe some of our national experts can talk about
that. Can I take a shot? I mean...
Okay.
I'll say quite a number of places.
You're going to answer.
Chicago, where I'm working now, in perpetuity, is fall off. They are going to keep those units as affordable.
Okay.
And I don't think you see anywhere where it's less than 10.
I'm sorry, I don't know the name.
Paul.
Yeah. Paul's raised are good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of this particular terrible housing slump, it's very difficult to get people qualified. I would say would look to the FHA program as, you know, getting to a lower down payment, probably a 5% down payment would be more of what we would expect, you know, in this market. But it may be appropriate, and I think the point that we made here is that these ordinances are tweaked and adjusted as they go along, and the best ones are refreshed kind of on a continuous basis. So it may be wise to start. I think anything less than 10 years is a mistake, frankly. But I would recommend, you know, I would say that I think that would be a reasonable start, given where we've passed down to this
today. Well, Mr. Chair, that's a very helpful colloquy that just took place for me. Thank you.
Okay. She has one thing. We have to get out of here. They're standing back there waiting. They have to set up.
Now, I was just going to say, there's not really an NPDU ordinance out there that's less than 10 years.
Okay.
Okay. Motion. Second. 15. All in favor?
Aye.
Let's go.
Thank you. Sorry I had to do that. But
I'm coming.
And I'm generally very supportive.
Yeah, I anticipate that we're going to have to make, you know, whatever.
Right.
And
anticipate. It may not even do a good job. Go through the other option.